I'm driving down a dirt road in the high Klamath Mountains on my way to meet with a respected Ootam and Chicano elder, Dennis Martinez. I reached out to Dennis some months ago to ask if he would be willing to share some of his ancestral healing knowledge, but he's been in poor health lately, so the communication has been slow going. Finally, after a few months of back and forth, he gave me the green light to come. The plan today is for us to go on a medicine walk so he can show me some of the native herbal remedies of the Northern California highlands. It seems straightforward enough, but an all-too-familiar sense of nervousness sets in as I near his house. Whenever I'm heading to meet with a tribal elder, I always get the jitters. I know in my heart that I was put here to do this work, and I've witnessed hundreds of universal signs supporting that truth. But working against me is that I'm a 6'2" white guy with brown hair and blue eyes, a spitting image of your average settler from the 1700s. Going into this work, you have to be aware of the damage that so-called wisdom seekers have done to these cultures. Many explorers have made contact, won the trust of medicine men and women, and studied under them only to return to the modern world and use that tightly guarded knowledge to make a name for themselves, perhaps taking a potent and undiscovered herb to a pharmaceutical company, mass marketing a new psycho-spiritual intervention, or, drumroll please, writing a book that shares sacred and highly secretive practices while positioning themselves as intrepid adventurers who risked life and limb to bring these pearls back to the masses. Some native groups are still susceptible to this kind of exploitation, but the indigenous people of North America are anything but. Their past 400 years have been one long tale of trickery and betrayal at the hands of the white man, and they're very wise to the ego-driven agendas that many of us harbor. Dennis and I squat by an old oak tree as he shows my team and me a particular area of tree bark that was harvested to treat respiratory issues. I've never heard of this remedy and suddenly feel obligated to warn him. Dennis, are you sure you want this knowledge to be shared with everyone out there? His eyes peer through and beyond my pupils. I'm quite sure he's seeing everything that is going on inside me. There are things that we will not share with people outside of our tribe, powerful medicines and universal secrets that we've held close for generations. Our knowledge was once an open book, but we saw only immaturity and greed-driven mishandling of these herbs and rites in response. But this is not one of them. Trust me, if this oak medicine weren't to be shared, you and I would not be talking right now. I've heard these words spoken by several First Nation elders, especially when they begin to get a better read on me. Before they will even meet, they ask about my intentions and who referred me, and they usually want a trusted mutual contact who can vouch for my integrity. There exist schools of knowledge that will never be written about in a book or documented in a movie, because it simply isn't allowed anymore. No matter where you live, I guarantee that yours is not the first human foot that stepped on that soil. We Homo sapiens have been here for a long time, and chances are very good that the flora and fauna in your neck of the woods have been studied intimately, tested, tuned into, and used for a variety of physical, spiritual, and psychological purposes. The notion that we need to venture off into unknown regions of the world to find our true nature is disrespectful to the very lands we were raised on. Plants were around a long time before we came into existence, and they've had a major hand in shaping who we've become. If we want to attain a deeper understanding of the medicines that exist around us, we need to approach the learning process with humility. Start with some good research. You can learn many of the basics from a botanical guide about your local flora. Look for medicinal herb walks and workshops on how to wildcraft your own medicine, a practice going through a renaissance of popularity in the modern world. If you want to go even deeper and reach out to indigenous wisdom keepers, make sure to do so with patience, permission, and respect. Chapter 7. The Jungle Healing Diet. Leave your drugs in the chemist's pot if you can heal the patient with food. Hippocrates. May 2nd, 2016. Tulum, Mexico. I'm seated at a long dinner table on a stone patio of a Spanish villa overlooking the Gulf of Mexico. To my left and right are a number of prominent figures in the world of natural medicine and nutrition. We've all been invited to this beautiful Mexican home outside the ancient Maya city of Tikal to meet minds and find new ways of broadening the reach of this vital information. Michelle and I sit side by side, listening to our 3-year-old son, River, play underneath a palm tree as a lavish dinner is laid out before us all. With so many leaders in the natural healing world at the same table, you can imagine the variety of particular dietary needs our tireless cooks have taken into consideration in preparing this meal. As we're eating, I notice a small bag of plantain chips tucked inconspicuously next to a steaming dish of gluten-free organic root vegetable soup with a bone broth base. I'm assuming a local must have forgotten these here after setting the table. Instinctively, I grab the bag and show it to Michelle, who responds with a big grin. We tear open the bag and begin to sneak chips into our mouths. I feel a nudge on my elbow from my neighbor to the left, a very sweet and talented man named Rick, who I met the night before. Do you guys have a death wish? If half of these folks saw you eating those, they'd turn on you like a pack of wolves. Rick's eyes are alight with amusement as he chides us under his breath. Michelle laughs guiltily as I lean over to Rick. I know, but it's totally worth the risk, I whisper confidentially. Let me tell you a little story about how the fried plantain chip saved our asses in the jungle. October 23rd, 2010, Loreto Province, Peru. It's day 9 of our healing retreat, and the first week has been a big adjustment for the patients, who are each experiencing highs and lows. One morning, the jungle feels like a paradise, and the next, it feels like the worst mistake of your life. There is nothing to do during your waking hours but sit and observe the emotions that are passing through your body. Snakes appear to be the forest friend to reckon with around these parts, as both patients and film crew are quickly learning. Sure, the black tarantulas are huge and, well, around, but they're fragile and relatively harmless. The snakes, on the other hand, can kill you quickly. Last night, Dan was walking back from Hut 5 by the light of a fading headlamp when he stopped to change the battery. As he was opening his pack, a 10-foot Shashupi pit viper slithered between his feet on the narrow jungle path and out of sight on the other side. The Shashupi, known as the Slow Bringer of Death, is legendary in these parts for its deadly venom, but is rarely sighted because it's nocturnal. Unfortunately, crazy people like us are too. Today we're going to get our first hard reading of how the patients are doing. Dr. Oswald Pertel, a respected physician in the city of Iquitos, agreed to join our jungle staff for the retreat and will be performing his first round of checkups on the patients to see how their bodies are responding to the treatment, diet, and overall experience. Many here are hoping that the hardships of their initial adjustment period will be offset by some good news. We split the film team into 2 units for the day, one to follow Dr. Pertel and me as we visit the patients, and another to continue filming the regular activities around the camp. There were a few slip-ups on our end in the first few days, and 1 or 2 incredible movie moments were missed. So we've made a pact to always have 2 separate teams filming in separate locations throughout the day. When we finally get back to the States and the editing room, this documentary will probably be cut down to 90 minutes or less. But at the pace we're going, there will be more than 250 hours of footage shot by day 31. Alberto, Dan, and I head out to meet Dr. Pertel at the main lodge, where we find him and Roman sitting at the dining table, discussing one of the patient files. We exchange greetings and get right to business. Nick, as you know, we've been monitoring basic vital signs each day and doing weekly blood work, but today we're going to try to get an assessment of the progress that each patient is making. In addition to Dr. Pertel, a nurse named Kelly has also been seeing the patients every other day since their arrival, reporting directly back to him. Their white shirts, neatly groomed hair, and overall hygiene are in stark contrast to our own rugged exteriors. The first hut we visit is Joel's. Joel, our type 2 diabetes patient from Tampa Bay, Florida, has been having a particularly hard time adjusting to jungle life. Through a couple of strained conversations with him this past week, he's made it clear to us that he thought the facility was going to be more modern and closer to civilization. He really doesn't like spiders and had an uncomfortable run-in with a tarantula a few nights ago. We make our way down the narrow dirt path to his hut, and he is already standing outside with a toothy smile, waiting to greet us. I guess he doesn't have much else going on today. "Hi, Joel. How are you feeling this morning?" Roman asks. "I'm doing great." Joel welcomes us into his little room as he responds. "I brought my own equipment to test my blood, and this morning I took a reading, and I was shocked. My blood sugar is at 60 right now. It's never been that low. That's what my kids' blood sugar is at. You know, I've got young kids who like to test their blood when I do mine, so I know what their number is, too. My blood sugar has dropped from 190 when I got here to 60 as of this morning." "That's lower than my kids," he repeats, beaming at us while talking a mile a minute. Roman translates everything into Spanish for Dr. Patel, who doesn't speak English fluently, and the physician's brows go up as he hears the blood count. "May I?" Patel asks as he points to Joel's portable blood glucose meter. "It's a nice one." "We took some blood samples from you on your second day here, correct?" Roman translates, and Joel nods while the doctor looks through his file and locates the numbers from that test. "Ah, interesting. You were at 190 when you first arrived, and that was taken before you ate breakfast. Have you eaten yet today?" "No. My breakfast usually comes in about an hour. Usually right about when the sun reaches that branch up there." Joel lowers his tone and adds, "They don't let us keep clocks or anything electronic around here." Patel's modern appearance must give the impression that he's not in on all the happenings, or that he'll be sympathetic to the deprivations Joel has endured. "So you have been eating the regular diet and just taking the jungle herbs that are being prescribed to you. You're off all your medications?" "Yes, sir. They took all my medications at the door. I'm just doing what they tell me." Patel looks at Roman to confirm. Roman nods. "Well, this is very good news. Keep doing what you're doing, and we'll check back in a few days." Joel excitedly shakes hands with the doctor and Roman as we leave. "Well, that's certainly a good start to the day." Dr. Patel asks Roman exactly what herbs Joel has been taking. "A plant called papaya and the bark of the tawari tree. You can speak with Edwin if there are any other questions." We walk farther down the trail and split off under the narrow side trail toward Jessica's dieta hut. At first, it doesn't look like anyone is inside, but my eyes adjust to the dark interior and make out a lump in a hammock strung across from the bed. "Hello?" Jessica's voice and demeanor are burdened, weak, but carry a hint of self-deprecating humor. She has been suffering from Crohn's disease for years, and it has only become worse as of late. The agonizing patches of intestinal inflammation that are characteristic of the disease have advanced all the way down her digestive tract into her colon. There is very little she can eat besides chicken broth and overcooked quinoa. The long trip here did not help matters at all. A moment later, three of us are standing next to the woman who is clearly trying to keep her body still as she lays suspended within the woven fabric. "How are you feeling, Jessica?" Dr. Patel asks. "Roman tells me you haven't been eating much this past week."
"Yeah, that's normal for me. I know it doesn't seem like I'm eating much, but there actually has been some mild improvement in my pain since I got here. I haven't thrown up in a few days, which I take as a good sign. I see here that you are taking sangre de grado, uña de gato, and guayusa in the morning and evening. Roman, am I missing any?"
Jessica is also participating in ayahuasca ceremonies, which have a strong effect on the digestive system, as you know. She is on a healing protocol very similar to what I prescribed for my own Crohn's disease many years ago. A momentary look of surprise flashes across Dr. Patel's face before he remembers that Roman himself was acutely ill with the same disease 10 years ago. "Well,
We need to keep a close eye on this one, says Dr. Pertot. Her tests show that she's anemic, and we need to make sure she gets more iron and overall calories into her system. I'm happy that the pain is improving, Jessica, but there is still a long way to go. I'll be back to work with you in a few hours, okay? Roman has been administering some additional treatments to Jessica using a few energy healing protocols that helped him with his own recovery. Jessica nods, and tears come to her eyes as we say goodbye. We stop by Nicola's hut next. Our Parkinson's patient from Connecticut is reclining in her bed under her mosquitero as we enter. A beam of hot sun is spilling across her bundled midsection. Given the humidity and temperature this morning, I'm not sure how she's able to tolerate the heat. The only part of her that is uncovered is her face, and there are no signs of perspiration. Her speech is heavily impaired by her condition, but she tells us she has been in bed resting after one of the best nights of sleep she has had in recent memory. Nicola then conveys a remarkable healing that she experienced yesterday during a personal session with Roman. She says something was released in her that has been locked away since the accident. The year before Nicola's Parkinson's symptoms came on, she was in a serious car accident that left her badly injured. In addition to broken bones, she endured severe whiplash that twisted one of her vertebrae out of position, leaving her with a permanent neck injury that prevented her from turning her head to the left and right. When we visited her for her intake interview, we witnessed this limitation firsthand. In addition to the tremors and tightness associated with her Parkinson's, Nicola had no mobility in her neck. There was no casual turn of her face toward or away from the camera. This simple movement took great effort, requiring that she turn her entire body to make the adjustment. "Watch this," she says, as a faint smile creeps across the increasingly responsive muscles of her face. Her head slowly begins to swivel as she turns it all the way to the left to look over her shoulder at the forest outside. Such a simple, yet monumental movement. She slowly turns it back to see us smiling broadly. "I haven't been able to do that in 5 years. Just that. Imagine." Nicola's voice seems to be a bit steadier now than it has been, and I detect the subtle elegance of an English accent where there hadn't been one just a day ago. There is someone being freed inside this woman, whom the world hasn't seen for a long time. "This is very impressive," Dr. Pertot says. "So in addition to the herbs you are taking, Roman has been doing some work on you? What kind of work?" The doctor has been brought into the fold on all the treatments, meal plans, and ceremonies. But this work that Nicola received is news to him. Roman speaks up before Nicola can answer. "Doctor, Nicola was feeling some pain and tension last night, so I performed a technique called cupping on her neck and upper spine to relieve it. I was taught this practice from a traditional Chinese medicine specialist some years ago, and use it routinely now with locals who complain of similar issues. The film team and I are already in on the scoop. We filmed the whole thing as it happened last night." The shaman first rubbed castor oil on his patient's neck and back, and then took out 2 clear cups. Each of these tulip-shaped vessels has a small hole in the bottom through which air is sucked out using a little pump. This creates a vacuum that literally pulls skin and muscle away from the body. After positioning 1 cup directly on the back of her neck, Roman traced his fingers along the muscle until his index finger stopped on a point about 3 inches below and slightly to the left. He put the 2nd cup on that point and began pumping the air out of both. If you've never seen cupping in action, it's a pretty odd thing to behold. The cups come in various sizes for use in different applications. Depending on how much air is pumped out, the clear glass becomes filled with skin, giving the impression of a swelling boil or a bubble of flesh. After the cups were emptied of sufficient air and filled about halfway with Nicola's skin and muscle tissue, Roman sang a short prayer in mixed Spanish and Quechua, and then began gently moving them back and forth along some invisible axis or ridge that he alone could see. About 3 minutes into the treatment, Roman said, "Nicola, do you feel that? I think I feel your vertebrae moving." A few seconds later, We all heard a quiet pop as Nicola let out a long sigh.
There it is, said Roman, deep in concentration. Keep breathing, Nicola. Is everything feeling okay?
I think so, she replied weakly. There was a quick shot of pain, but it feels wonderful now. What did you do?
All I did with the cuffs is soften up the tight muscle and tissue around your neck bones and pull them out of the way.
Your spine did the rest. Our bodies know which way they want to be aligned. We sometimes just need to get rid of the blockages.
Roman relays all of this to Dr. Patel as a physician checks Nicola's pulse, lungs, and pupils.
And what are the herbs she is taking? The doctor asks.
We are giving her small doses of a plant called Chirisanengo, which is also called a thousand needles. Plant stimulates all the nerve endings in the body and is often used here for neurological disorders like Parkinson's. We are also considering a few Doe treatments once Habin gets here in a few days. But as you probably know, Doe, Rugmansia grandiflora, is extremely dangerous and must be taken with extreme caution. I will let you know if we choose to go that route.
Very good. I see both of these noted on the file here. Please keep me updated as to how the Chirisanengo treatments go.
We leave Nicola and begin making our way out to huts 4 through 8, which are located deeper in the rainforest.
Things are coming along very nicely with Nicola, observes Dr. Bertel as we walk. I trust you will tell me before you add any additional treatments to a patient's healing plan?
Of course, Maestro, the shaman responds, glancing back at me.
A few hours later, as we approach the last Dieta hut, the tally is 5-2. 5 of our patients are experiencing very encouraging signs of improvement, and 2 are struggling but still optimistic. Our last visit, Roman tells the doctor, is to Gary, who has late-stage neuroendocrine cancer.
How far away is he staying? Dr. Bertel asks.
Not too far, I hope, with an illness like that.
Another 1/2 mile, more or less. Dr. Patel looks at the shaman, and then at me, with an expression of concern that seems to be his resting face.
Upon arriving at the center, Gary politely insisted on taking Hut 8, structure farthest away from the rest of the camp. His condition is advanced, and we've known his limitations since visiting him in a small apartment in Garibaldi, Oregon, a little over 1 month ago. But he's been a rugged outdoorsman his entire life, and is one of the few patients who are comfortable being such a long distance from the center's main buildings. The shamans and patient care staff have been checking on Gary more frequently than they do the others, given his advanced state. And the 62-year-old deep-sea diver seems to have taken quite a liking to his outpost. From our longhouse to Hut 8, it's about a 25-minute walk. After about 10 minutes and a few stream crossings, we approach Gary's jungle residence, perched on the top of a little slope, looking down at the wetlands that we are currently trudging through. He hears the crunch of our footfalls in the underbrush and shouts down to us, "Hey, fellas, come on in." The screen door creaks as we pull it open, and we find him swinging in his hammock with his journal resting on his belly. There's a wide grin across his gray-bearded face.
"Good afternoon, Gary. How did you sleep?" Roman asks as the rest of us find some standing room.
Gary is exuberant. "I have trouble getting past the joy of this place at night," he says. "It's all romance. There's no fear involved in any of the sounds and creatures that come crawling around my hut. They're like, 'Hey, I'm over here. Somebody come and talk to me. No, I'm over here.' It's just beautiful, and not so loud that it's uncomfortable, but loud enough that it keeps your attention. I'm thrilled by it." Dr. Patel steps forward and gently puts his hand on Gary's forehead, which is glistening with a light sweat. "How are you feeling right now?"
"Well, I'm hesitantly optimistic. The intense pain in my stomach that's caused by the small tumors in my intestines is almost completely gone. This is a big deal. Since I was diagnosed, there have been days that I could barely move because the pain was so bad. These past few days, it's become more of a background noise that is much more tolerable. I'm not sure whether it's the herbs or the ceremonies or both, but something is shifting for sure." Even as he says this, we can hear labored breaths between his words. His demeanor is cheerful, but it's obvious the man is having some difficulty adjusting to the heat and the thickness of the air.
That is great to hear, says Dr. Patel. Would you mind if I examine you?
Absolutely, please do. Gary raps with us about some of his adventures diving off the coast of his hometown in western Oregon with his core group of deep-sea buddies as a physician checks his vitals and listens to his chest cavity with his stethoscope.
You are brave to make the long journey here from the United States, sir.
Patel's usually serious expression melts into kind-eyed admiration for the man lying in front of him. The medicines of the jungle are powerful. A few of my own family members have recovered from their illnesses in exactly the same way you are attempting to. Good luck until my next visit, and please stay hydrated. The sun is about halfway between high noon and dusk as we begin our long walk back to the meeting house. Once Gary is out of earshot, Roman turns to the physician, who appears deep in thought, and asks,
"So, what do you make of it all?"
"I'm very happy with much of what we saw today. The patients seem to be thriving for the most part, but..." He stops for a brief moment and turns to look at Roman intently.
"You must transfer Gary to a closer hut. It's very good that his pain has subsided, but the man is still in his final days with cancer. This is the responsible thing to do."
Roman puts up a few minutes of polite resistance, pointing out that it was Gary's choice to be on the outer limits alone, but he ultimately defers to the physician's judgment. "We will move him to Hut 6, one of our closest patient houses, tomorrow. I think Joel will be okay with switching." With that settled, Dr. Patel and the shaman begin to compare notes on each of the patients, coming to many of the same conclusions about how best to proceed. We carefully navigate the forest underbrush as the two healers from opposite backgrounds create a game plan for the next week. They begin to speak in greater depth and their cadence becomes quicker. After a few minutes, I get tangled in some of the Spanish medical terminology and check out of the conversation, letting the jungle noises and sensations wash over me for a minute. We walk by a trail that leads off down a small slope to the bank of a babbling stream, ending at the hut belonging to our prostate cancer patient, John. I can just barely make out the thatched roof of his residence in the distance, and I wonder how he's doing. Of all our patients, John is the one who has struggled most with the deeper aspects of himself. As he describes it, he has always chosen to be a lone wolf, not part of the pack. Somehow, in the jungle, despite his isolation, he's feeling this choice more deeply than he ever has before. And at the same time, he's struggling with the concept of relinquishing control of his healthcare, his daily routine, and especially his diet to others, even those he believes hold his best chance of beating cancer. His exasperated outbursts of rage have been cast at everyone from the staff who brings his food to Roman himself, the latter much more frequent and intense. But we all recognize that John is merely fighting the same battle all our patients are facing in one manner or another, though perhaps externalizing a bit more. Our guests are in solitary confinement out here, with doors that open onto dense jungle that is teeming with fauna and flora. There is no running water or electricity. The only other amenity they have is a little wooden outhouse that accompanies each building, which is nothing more than a shack on top of a deep hole in the ground. Plus, whatever critters might have decided to take up residence. There is no escape from your environment, from your thoughts, or from yourself. But something is happening out here that we as filmmakers are on the outside of. While we are busy shooting a documentary on each patient's experience and helping run the retreat itself, there is an inner adjustment or immersion gradually taking hold of them each day between our visits. After a few days of initial turmoil as they settled in, everything seems to have quieted down. Each of our guests has begun to surrender to the environment they're in, almost as if the spirit of Pachamama is beginning to take hold of them, whispering secrets that only they can hear. It's inspiring, but also somewhat eerie to witness. The film crew and I don't have it quite as tough as the patients do. When we're not rolling camera, we stay in a longhouse constructed in much the same way as the Dieta huts, but spacious enough to sleep 10 people comfortably. Total isolation isn't a part of our daily reality.
Still, we're working extremely long days in the heat, with no access to any comforts from the outside world. Our cameras are the only semblance of modernity that we possess. But wielding these heavy beasts often feels like more of a burden than not having them at all. We're filming patients as they go through their personal and occasionally hellish trials in an effort to overcome their illnesses. It's an intense and trying environment that can disorient you if you're not focused. We're eating the same limited diet as the patients, working in the same oppressive heat, and sitting in many of the same healing ceremonies that they are. Each day, the hum of the rainforest is penetrating deeper, revealing more about each of us. With no electricity, hot water, or other basic amenities of home, the only choice is to embrace the way of the locals. I handpicked this team not only for their film experience, but also for their ability to handle themselves calmly in intense situations. These are extraordinary individuals, but even the strongest is challenged in an environment like this. The loud hum of our winged and scaled forest friends is beginning to subside as the sun comes up on day 12. I'm mostly awake, plodding through blue-green forest toward the community well where we get our water and take care of basic morning and evening hygienic needs. The generator-powered well pump is rumbling when I get there, and I see Alberto brushing his teeth over a small bucket resting on a nearby ledge. "You're up early," I say. "Couldn't sleep?" It's not unusual to see someone down here at this hour, but Alberto is definitely not an early riser. "I'm catching a ride to Cahuide. I hear there's a little restaurant there that makes eggs and yucca fries. Want to come? It's only a mile or two from here." I squeeze paste onto my toothbrush and run the bristles across my molars for a few seconds to buy myself some time to formulate a diplomatic response. Alberto is an impressive sound technician and indispensable in the field, but I've learned the hard way that he's extremely sensitive to criticism. "Alberto, I need you here. And we all agreed that we're in this with the patients and won't cheat on the meal plan. If the staff finds out that we're sneaking around, it'll cause a rift. We need to be a team right now. I'm not having fucking quinoa and manzanita tea for breakfast again today," Alberto says in exasperation. "You want us to be filming 12 hours a day in the middle of the heat and rain, getting bitten by God knows what, and I'm fine with that. All I'm asking for is some eggs." The leaves on the path behind us crunch as Dan makes his way down the path in our direction. "What's going on?" "I'm headed to Cahuide for breakfast, if boss will let me. Want to come?" "Wait, I thought we had a pact that the jungle diet applies to all of us." Dan looks at me and I can see his play. He overheard our conversation and is down here playing dumb to help me reel in Alberto. "Listen," I say. "I'm not loving the food here either. If I hadn't made a commitment to the process, I'd wander down the road at lunchtime and see if anyone had a beer and some fried fish. But it's not what we agreed to. Every one of you signed on to this film knowing what it was going to take. I'm asking you to keep your word to me and the rest of the team." Dan nods in agreement. Outnumbered, Alberto mutters something under his breath about this not being optimal to his unique dietary needs and takes his leave of us, trudging off deeper into the jungle in the direction away from the road and Cahuide. "He just needs to walk it off. This place gets you, know what I mean?" Dan speaks while we both watch him disappear into the bush. "As long as he's back when we start filming in an hour, he can do whatever he needs to do." We both know he'll be back. Where else is there to go? Connected to the mission, but alarmingly disconnected from the outside world we once knew, we must navigate every day with care. Each of us is beginning to realize that we have no more reprieve from this jungle healing experiment than the patients do, and the truth isn't always pretty. The jungle healing diet is very basic, intended for sustenance, not pleasure. After all, pleasure is at its core simply a means of distraction. The jungle diet consists of boiled and roasted green plantains, well-cooked root vegetables, like yucca and cassava, a bony and flavorless fish called boca chico, quinoa, very simple broths, and sometimes jungle fruit, like papaya and coconut for breakfast. There is little to no salt, no spices, and absolutely no animal fats on this meal plan. The shamans believe that the delicate life energies and compounds in each of the herbs that are being prescribed, including Banisteriopsis caapi, one of the ingredients in ayahuasca, can be easily diluted and destroyed if the patient eats too heavy a diet. Contrary to the detox diets that are popular in the modern world, which consist of green smoothies, lemon cayenne shots, and saltwater liver flushes, the foods that are prescribed here are bland and relatively devoid of any palate-satisfying sensation. Even a raw vegan diet can thrill the taste buds, but not this one. No comfort or escape to be found in the cuisine that is coming out of the Paititi kitchen hut. The principles of this food regimen stem from the traditional dieta used by shamans, apprentices, and patients in this region of the world. In order to understand and harness a healing plant's power, the patient needs to keep a very pure diet that doesn't interfere with the subtle energetics and overall character of the medicinal herb. In addition to the sustenance-only food options, the patient is strongly advised to abstain from sex or any stimulation in that region whatsoever during the healing dieta. In this case, 32 days, for similar reasons. The medicine men and women strongly believe that every bit of the patient's focus and life force needs to be preserved and concentrated on the healing task at hand. It makes you think. We run around this world, chasing after every sparkly object, pouring our precious, finite energy into anything we chance upon. This work is not about finding some miracle cure that exists outside us, but about getting rid of the blocks and leaks that are inhibiting our ability to see clearly and heal ourselves. This powerful ancient dieta practice can be done anywhere on the planet, and has been for thousands of years. The language and rituals around it are the only things that vary. Alberta returns 30 minutes later, apologizes gruffly for his momentary lapse of team spiritedness, and starts putting his audio gear together for the day's filming assignments. It's what I expected he'd do, but there's an inner sigh of relief just the same. I've got to figure out some way of giving these guys a break. Later that day, as the sun is setting, the crew and I are busy logging the footage from the day when we hear footsteps approaching. It's the guard, Arbildo, walking and whistling toward our longhouse with a bulging plastic sack hanging from one of his hands. It's a Herculean bag of fried plantain chips. When we see this golden treasure, every activity in our quarters comes to a crashing halt. "I was in Iquitos today and bought some plátanos for you all to eat at Belen Market. They are the best I've ever had. Want a treat?" Arbildo has long since left the tribal ways and isn't familiar with the rigid dietary protocol we're adhering to. He's more than happy to share his heavenly fried plantain chips with our haggard group of gringo filmmakers. "Please, for the love of God, can we eat this man's chips?" Alberto pleads. "They fell right into our lap." His entreaty starts off serious, but the corner of his mouth curls as he tries to hold back a smile. I look at Brock, Dan, and Michelle, who are staring at the plastic sleeve of greasy gold. The decision has already been made. Nobody hears about this, agreed? That night, we sit huddled around the miraculous sack of chips and savor every crispy bite, unbeknown to the shaman's impatience. Like children who are getting away with the most punishable of crimes, we grin at one another by candlelight. The salty oil on our fingertips is a dose of home that soothes something deep inside us, but it's also a sobering reminder of how far we are from the lives we know. May 2nd, 2016, Tulum, Mexico. The Yucatan breeze picks up as Michelle and I finish telling Rick and his partner our story of plantain chips in the Amazon. Paleo-friendly, low-glycemic cuisine is being served on the Mexican terrace where we sit, and other guests are beginning to take notice of our intimate huddle at the end of the long table. Somewhere during the story, we instinctually slid our chairs closer together, like co-conspirators in a secret plot. "Tell me what happened next. Which patients were cured? We need to know." Mission accomplished. Rick is clearly no longer concerned about the negative health impact of our plantain chips. "That's all I can tell you. You'll have to watch the movie to find out. As the health food comes our way, Michelle and I quickly devour every remaining plantain chip in the mysteriously placed little bag. We offer the last one to Rick, who accepts it like a wafer on Sunday Mass. Delicious. Grandpa's Kitchen. Mastering the basics with reverence. My Uncle John tells a great story about his first encounter with his stepfather, my late grandfather, on my father's side, after whom I was named. He met my grandmother a few years after World War II, when he was in his early 30s, and it was love at first sight. My grandmother, Frances L. Rose, always told us he was the most handsome man she had ever seen, and oh, what a beautiful car he had. But she had a complicated life when they first encountered each other. A year before they met, my grandma had done something that was unspeakable in those days. After 10 years in an unhappy marriage, she had made an unconventional choice and decided to amicably separate from her husband. This left her fending for herself and her two sons, John and Joe, with only the meager livelihood from her job as a beautician. My Uncle John was only 7 when he was first brought to meet his mom's hot new romance. Like most kids in this situation, he wasn't too excited about this man who was trying to take the place of his father. John was determined not to befriend this intruder. They walked into the kitchen of my grandpa's Brooklyn apartment, and there he was, with his back to them, pulling things out of the refrigerator, getting ready to cook. He turned and saw them in the doorway. "You must be John. Say, can I make you some scrambled eggs for breakfast?" "Eggs? I don't like eggs," my young uncle said defiantly. Smiling, my grandpa leaned across the counter. "Oh, I promise you'll like mine." With that, he cracked 2 eggs in a pan coated with butter and did what we've all seen him do hundreds of times since. He created the most delicious eggs of all time. My grandpa won his future stepson over that morning. From that day forward, he and my uncle began to trust and ultimately develop a deep love for each other. Watching my grandpa cook was one of the most therapeutic experiences of my childhood. The man did everything with such care and intention, from slicing an onion to sprinkling a little extra dried basil on top of a marinara sauce to hand-drying the pan after the meal was over. Each step was performed with reverence, carefully following some inherited code of culinary ethics. There was nothing too simple or basic for his skilled hands. Anything that came into his awareness was treated as though it were the only thing in the universe at that moment. The first thing he ever taught me to cook was an egg. In his opinion, mastering the perfect egg was one of the hardest things to do in the kitchen. If you understood the subtle effects of hot stainless steel and butter on a yolk and white, you could apply these to almost any other dish, simple or complex. First, there is the heat at which you cook your egg. Some might be tempted to crank it up to high because technically eggs are fried. But there is a sweet spot that isn't uniform across all stovetops. It has to be sensed with the hand, held about 5 inches above the flame or electric burner. Somewhere between medium and high is the point at which a pat of butter will melt and sizzle, but will not smoke. This is the right heat for egg making. There's nothing else in the natural world that behaves quite like an egg when it's cracked open into a hot pan. The character changes from liquid goo into something beautifully symmetrical right before your eyes. Who was the first person to discover this culinary secret? Like most culinary leaps, it probably happened accidentally. An egg falls from a tree onto a hot rock that has been baking in the sun all day. A two-legged passerby takes notice while walking through the woods and calls his or her clan mates over. Somebody is brave enough to have a taste. Evolution. If you think about it, the egg is essential to just about every culture of food worldwide, accepted by all. Baked goods, desserts, sauces, soups, deep-fry batters, mayonnaises and dressings, not to mention breakfast, would not be the same without this oblong cornerstone. The second rule of perfectly cooked eggs is to know what to look for. The scrambled egg, when closely watched, gives all kinds of cues that let the cook know when it's time to push, pull, and flip with the spatula. How the bubbles are forming in the middle. How the edges ripple in spatters of grease. The thickness of the underbelly that is making contact with the pan. There is information in all of these visual indicators, and making perfect scrambled eggs requires attention to each one. Otherwise, you'll wind up with something that is probably edible, but is miles from taste bud bliss. Last and possibly most important, a master knows how and when to touch the egg during its brief rendezvous with the frying pan. Because of its name, many make the mistake of literally scrambling their egg to death, swashbuckling with their spatula until all that remains is a mushy mess. This is not the way of the enlightened scrambler. Every touch changes the texture of your egg, and each move must be done with finesse. The fluffy, moist, and savory scramble that you might encounter at a high-end breakfast joint takes only 4 or 5 touches with a utensil to make. Grandpa Nick taught me that the right pan with good heat and proper shortening will take care of 90% of the process. From there, it requires only an attentive eye and a steady hand to create the perfect egg. My grandfather was this way about everything. Full presence. That's how he was taught by his dad. He never became too good at something to spend that extra time and dedication on the most basic task. Everything mattered. Everything was sacred. The notion of quality tends to carry with it a connotation of the old-fashioned way. Back when things were done right, by hand, with care, nearby. When craftsmanship actually meant something. But the underlying principle of quality is much older than the words old-fashioned would lead us to believe. It boils down to an essential mantra that is downright ancient. Master the basics. And the rest will follow. Chapter 8. Life and Death. October 26th, 2010. Loreto Province, Peru. It's the 12th night since the healing retreat began, and the team and I are packing it in for the evening in our sleeping quarters on the second floor of the thatch-roofed longhouse. Dan and Alberto are lounging in hammocks, discussing the highlights of the day, while Michelle logs some final notes about the developments with each patient on a large sheet of drawing paper spread across the wood plank floor. Brock is at his usual evening post, at a laptop in the corner, squeezing out the last of our fading battery power to back up all the footage from the day. I'm fussing with a mosquito net when the walkie-talkie crackles on. Nick and Roman, please come to Hut 6 right away. It's Andrea, one of our aides, who is on the early night shift, making rounds to ensure each patient has what he or she needs before bed. She is trying to keep an even tone as she speaks, but the urgency in her voice is clear. Hut 6 is Gary. Copy that. Andrea, is everything okay? Silence. Then, it's an emergency. Come right away. I turn toward the team, and Brock is already putting his boots on. I'm coming with you. 30 seconds later, the two of us are running through dark jungle in the direction of Gary's hut, down a winding trail, across a stream on a small bridge, and up the opposite bank. 5 minutes later, we see the shadow of the Moloka looming against the night sky as we approach. Roman! I yell up into the attic of the ceremonial temple, where the shaman usually sleeps in order to be close to the patients at night in case of scenarios like this. At Dr. Patel's suggestion, we recently persuaded Gary to move to the Dieta hut closest to the Moloka. No answer. He must already be there. Branches whip at us as we barrel through the woods, just beginning to make out the faint flicker of headlamps and hushed voices through the trees. A few seconds later, we see what all the lights are trained on. A pale, half-naked figure is slumped over on the wooden front steps of the hut, surrounded by 4 dark silhouettes. Gary, Keep talking. Tell us what you are feeling right now. Roman has his hand on Gary's bare back. Edwin, Habin, and the nurse Kelly look up at us as we draw closer.
I'm so hot, says Gary.
Hi, Nick.
Gary's voice is labored, but still has the warm and friendly note that has won the hearts of everyone now standing by his side. Edwin steps forward with a wet towel and wipes Gary's forehead and back.
I'm having a hard time getting enough air.
Take nice, easy breaths, my friend. Roman is pressing his fingers on a few points along Gary's arm.
Hard to breathe.
The words fall short as his eyes squeeze shut, body suddenly slumping toward the ground. Two of us step forward and catch him as he tips off the steps.
Gary.
Gary.
Roman slaps him hard across the face.
Gary!
His face is blank, his large frame motionless.
He's not breathing. I'm going to start CPR, Roman says.
The six of us crouch beside Gary as Roman props up his chin, opens his airway, and stacks two hands on his bare chest. With elbows locked, he pumps downward while counting under his breath. One, two, three. Administering cardiopulmonary resuscitation in textbook fashion, Roman glances up at me with an expression I will never forget. This is the first and only time I have ever seen a look of fear on the shaman's face. After 30 compressions, Roman opens Gary's mouth, makes sure the airway is clear, pinches his nose, and blows a full breath into his lungs. His sternum rises faintly as the air expands his chest. After delivering a second breath, Roman brings his ear up to Gary's nose and mouth, listening for any sign of respiration.
Come on, Gary, stay with us.
The color is steadily draining from Gary's face as a light drizzle begins to fall on us all. While Roman works, Kelly puts her index and middle fingers on his neck, trying to find a pulse. Edwin does the same with Gary's left wrist.
Se ha ido. Edwin says gently, Se ha ido, hermanos.
He has gone, brothers. Roman completes 30 more compressions and moves again toward Gary's head.
Let me try, please, I find myself saying as I crawl around to take Roman's place.
Roman nods. My left hand goes to Gary's forehead as I bring my ear to his nose and mouth. Not even the faintest sign of breath. I flash my headlamp into his open mouth to make sure his tongue is out of the way and then bring my mouth over the top of his, creating a tight seal around his cold, lifeless lips. The next 60 seconds are a series of well-intended but pointless gestures. After 18 hard pumps onto the sternum, which seems ready to crack, I realize we're trying to save a life that, as Edwin said, has already gone. I sit back, and the six of us stare at one another in wide-eyed silence. From frenzied action to sober understanding of finality.
Adentro. Adentro. Necesitamos moverlo adentro.
The low rumble of Habin's voice breaks the silence. We need to move him inside. In collective agreement, we once again set ourselves to motion. Edwin unrolls a woven blanket on the floor of Gary's hut and lights a few candles, while the rest of us hoist Gary up and into the small screened-in room. There is no sadness, remorse, or fear as we do these things. A larger force is at play right now, overriding any pre-programmed response we might expect to have. We're functioning as one organism now, doing what serves the highest good from one second to the next. Animated and coursing with life only a few minutes ago, the flesh and bone that was once Gary now lays motionless in front of us. The candlelight plays off the contours of his face, occasionally tricking the eye. Was that a twitch? Did his hand just stir? We sit in total silence, holding space for something infinitely larger than us. There is no visible interaction occurring, but the room is awash
in an intensity that has us all entranced. There is a download in progress. 5 minutes pass, then 10. Something is transpiring just above Gary's body. My eyes are transfixed by this, and it's overtly apparent that our awareness itself is playing some important role. We are witnessing something unwitnessable. The air in front of our faces is charged with an energy emanating from the burly vessel that is stretched in front of us. Then, just like that, it lifts and is gone. Gary is no longer here. This is not romanticizing or theorizing, but plainly obvious to everyone in the hut as the collective trance subsides instantly. I look at Roman and can't control the smile that is beginning to wash across my face. We've just witnessed a soul departing from its deceased body. This is something that many have experienced with their loved ones, but in this setting, the miracle is so pronounced, so palpable, that everyone in our trusted circle is overcome with awe, gratitude, and happiness? Silence is broken by Roman, who sings an Ícaro to send Gary's soul off to the ancestors. Once his song is complete, we begin to check in with one another, sharing what we witnessed, and turning our focus to the practical question of, what now? The other patients will be awake in 6 hours, and many of those who are now in Gary's hut will need to be up and in service in 5. Roman and I agree that he should use a satellite phone to call the coroner's office in Iquitos and arrange transport of Gary's body back to the port city in the morning. You guys all go get some rest. I'll stay here with Gary until sunrise. The words just seem to come out of my mouth without any decision on my part. A younger version of me would have been mortified to stay alone with a dead body in a little candlelit jungle hut. But that me no longer exists. Are you sure, brother? We can take turns or work in pairs if you'd like. Roman looks older somehow as he asks a question he already knows the answer to. I'll be fine, really. See you all in the morning. There is medicine in every challenging experience. And sitting cross-legged on the floor beside Gary's vessel, as the rain falls around us, is rewiring my understanding of my own mortality. We Westerners shelter ourselves from death and dying at any expense. Even when it comes to our own loved ones, we tend to hire professional services to take care of the body and handle all the arrangements. We're so fascinated by violence and murder on television and in the news, but when it comes to confronting death in our own lives, we are as scared as children. The majority of people in the Western world identify with one of the major religions, Christianity, Judaism, or Islam. All of them hold in their core teachings the ultimate goal of living a selfless life of connectedness and service to others. Those who follow said guidelines are rewarded with some type of heavenly afterlife. The rules and reward are fairly straightforward, yet this same culture is plagued by an unwillingness to embrace aging and the ultimate death of our physical form. I once heard a Buddhist mystic say, "The root of all fear is death, and the goal of all religions is to help humans to overcome that fear." The candles burn low as the hours pass, ultimately extinguishing themselves. Darkness feels appropriate now, so, like Gary, I stay where I sit, holding final space for the deep-sea diver from Garibaldi. Early the following morning, we arrange transport of Gary's body to the coroner's office in Iquitos. Roman and a few other locals accompany his remains for the 65-kilometer ride. There will be authorities to answer to, and the U.S. Embassy will most likely be involved. Once they've departed, Andrea and I visit each of the patients and ask them to meet us in the upper level of the Maloca
after they eat their breakfast. Most of them are